Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russian anti-corruption activist Alexei Navalny has been sentenced to jail for a second time this year after organizing protests in Moscow and other cities. The protests drew thousands and were some of the biggest since 2012. People chanted "Russia without Putin," a reference to President Vladimir Putin, and "Russia will be free." Scores were arrested. Navalny, sentenced to 30 days in prison, said he was pleased with the turnout and amazed that rallies took place in cities like Saratov, Penza, and Norilsk, as well as Moscow and St. Petersburg. University of Melbourne Russia analyst Leslie Templeman-Holmes said Navalny has been calling such protests for years and was sentenced to 15 days in jail earlier this year.
But he's also been subject to much heavier sanctions. The Russian government has been targeting him for some time, ever since he made it clear that corruption, not only in the government, but also actually in the private sector, in corporate sector, that these would be things that he was going to severely criticize.
A White House spokesman condemned the detentions. Sean Spicer said detaining peaceful protesters, human rights observers, and journalists is an affront to core democratic values. He called on the Russian government to immediately release all peaceful protesters. Moscow called the demonstrations illegal. A powerful 6.3 magnitude earthquake struck the west coast of Turkey and the Greek island of Lesbos Monday, killing at least one person. The epicenter of the quake was some 80 kilometers northwest of the Turkish coastal city Izmir and 15 kilometers south of Lesbos. The quake was felt as far away as Athens, more than 350 kilometers to the southwest of Lesbos. This is VOA News. Qatar's foreign minister said Monday his government is prepared to negotiate an end to tensions with its Gulf neighbors a week after Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain cut ties with Doha over allegations it funds terrorists. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani was in Paris.
Whatever is related to the collective security of the Gulf countries, Qatar is willing to sit and negotiate and discuss what are the effects of our policy on the collective security of the Gulf countries. Whatever is related to their accusations that we are interfering in their internal affairs, they have the full right to put the accusation, and we have the full right to respond and to react to this accusation.
He said the region cannot afford further escalation of tensions. In Washington, President Donald Trump expressed his own concerns about the funding of terrorists in the Gulf region.
One of the big things that we did, and you're seeing it now with Qatar and all of the things that are actually going on in a very positive fashion, we are stopping the funding of terrorism. They are going to stop the funding of terrorism. And it's not an easy fight, but that's a fight we're going to win. You have to starve the beast, and we're going to starve the beast.
Qatar denies supporting groups like the Muslim Brotherhood or having close ties with Iran. U.S.-backed Syrian rebels pushed deeper into Raqqa, nearing the old city of the Islamic State-held city. The Kurdish and Arab militia hold the eastern neighborhood of al-Mashleb. Sunday took control of the western neighborhood of al-Rumaniyah. British Prime Minister Theresa May met Monday with members of a ruling Conservative Party after calling an early election last week in which many of her members lost seats and the Tories lost their majority. Mrs. May was described as contrite at a meeting of the so-called 1922 meeting, attended by parliamentarian Jacob William Rees-Mogg.
She recognized that it would be beneficial to be more open and that Den Downing Street had been a bit closed, and now that's what she's going to do. It's a really impressive and good performance.
The Prime Minister was said to have promised to clean up the mess of the election by working more widely with her party. A U.S. appeals court Monday upheld the ruling of another court decision blocking President Trump's temporary travel ban, targeting people coming to the U.S. from six mostly Muslim countries, prompting this response from White House spokesman Sean Spicer.
I think we can all attest that these are very dangerous times, and we need every available tool at our disposal to prevent terrorists from entering the United States and committing acts of bloodshed and violence. We continue to be confident that the president's executive order to protect this country is fully lawful and ultimately will be upheld by the Supreme Court.
The appeals court said the president overstepped his authority. An international study led by a team from the University of Washington Monday warned that obesity affects one of every 10 people in the world and is rising in countries both rich and poor more quickly in children than adults. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 13th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. An IGAD summit on South Sudan ends with a call for the full implementation of the August 2015 peace agreement.
Instead of letting IGAD take the lead, some organization or some outfit within the African Union or the United Nations should take charge right now, because what we've seen is inaction, and that inaction has resulted in more deaths and destruction in South Sudan.
Brian Adebat is Associate Director of Policy at the U.S.-based Enough Project. Meanwhile, the Enough Project has called for a rethinking of IGAD's involvement in South Sudan. Egypt has the highest percentage of obese adults, according to a new study, and aid groups assist Nigeria's government in rehabilitating rescue Chibok girls.
Because they had aspirations, that was why their parents put them in school from where they were abducted. Therefore, when they stabilize and they recover, we'll still put them back in school.
Aisha Jubai Al-Hassan is Nigeria's Women Affairs Minister. Zambia's robotic team gets ready for the first Global Challenge robotic competition next month in Washington, D.C. And Norway hosts a conference of spiritual and indigenous leaders to help fight deforestation of global rainforests. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Leaders of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, known as IGAD, have concluded their summit on South Sudan with a call for the full implementation of the August 2015 peace agreement as the only viable way to bring about peace and stability in South Sudan. The leaders called on all parties to take urgent steps to draw up concrete plans and timeline to compensate for the delay and revitalize the full implementation of the agreement. They welcome the launching of a national dialogue by President Salva Kiir Mayardit and the South Sudan government, but call for making the dialogue all-inclusive, genuine, and transparent. President Salva Kiir did not attend the summit held Monday in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Brian Adeba, policy director of the Washington-based Enough Project, says IGAD is falling short on its mission to promote and maintain peace and security in South Sudan.
No, it is not doing enough, mainly because it is very divided. All the countries in the IGAD grouping have varying interests and competing interests among themselves with regard to South Sudan. And that competition has stymied any effective handling of the conflict in South Sudan.
John Prendergast, the Enough Project's founding director, writes that South Sudan needs a new, dynamic, and inclusive peace process. Was that not the vision of the August 2015 peace deal? What went wrong then that can be corrected in a new peace process?
Well, since the peace process stalled in August last year, in July last year, the inadvertent consequence of that collapse is the emergence of new actors in the conflict. Now, the emergence of the actors has worsened the humanitarian situation as well as exacerbated this fighting. When the peace agreement was signed, there was no conflict in Western Bahr el-Ghazal. There was no conflict in the Equatorius. Right now, those regions are aflame. And therefore, what is obvious here is that new actors have come into the conflict and they need to be accommodated at the negotiating table. This conflict is no longer a contest between two parties, and that has to be taken into consideration if at all the peace process is to move forward.
So how do you engage the new actors exactly?
By convening a conference that brings them to the table and asking what their grievances are and treating them as partners as well.
Now, Brian, you argue that people who have personally profited during the conflict have little to no incentive to negotiate in good faith. So with that in mind, how will a new process work if there's no motivation among leaders?
The lack of motivation here has to be addressed, and this is where the question of exerting leverage comes into play. And the best possible way to get at these people, to sort of compel them to come to the negotiating table and talk in good faith, is to enact punitive or pressures on them on the financial side, for instance. Make sure that you hit them in the wallet, target their businesses, target their movement, target their networks, ensure that they are locked out of the global financial system. That's one. Secondly, a conflict proliferates because of the presence of the wide availability of small arms. So the next level of exerting leverage should focus on an arms embargo that targets both sides on all sides in this conflict so that no one has access to arms to enable them to continue fighting.
The peace process has largely been led by JMAC through IGAD, but at which point should the African Union step in to take a more direct role in South Sudan?
Well, the African Union has this perception or this policy where regional bodies take care of localized conflicts. For instance, if it's in East Africa, IGAD takes charge of that. But what we have seen now, IGAD is too divided to even take a very realistic approach to solving the conflict. Several things have happened on the negotiating front. There was the Ethiopian foreign minister who was very engaged, but he resigned to go and compete for the World Health Organization top position. The successor is not as plugged in on South Sudanese affairs. And frankly, he also came in at a time when there were so many pressing domestic issues to address on the home front. So the attention that IGAD should have focused on South Sudan has been diverted, and that needs to be addressed. And that's why we say instead of letting IGAD take the lead, some organization or some outfit within the African Union or the United Nations should take charge right now, because what we've seen is inaction, and that inaction has resulted in more deaths and destruction in South Sudan, and this situation is untenable and should not continue.
Brian Adebat is Associate Director of Policy at the U.S.-based Enough Project. He spoke with Ian Bio of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program. The Nigerian government recently negotiated the release of 82 of the Chibok girls abducted by Boko Haram in 2014. Foreign governments and aid groups have been assisting the young women as they undergo rehabilitation in the Nigerian capital. Chika Odua has the story from Abuja, with contributing reporting by the VOA's Hausa service.
106 liberated Chibok girls remain in the capital under the custody of the Nigerian Ministry of Women Affairs. The majority were released by Boko Haram during a prisoner swap last month, just more than 3 years after their kidnapping. Others were freed via negotiations in October. Three of the girls escaped on their own. The ministry is providing them with skills training, educational classes, and psychosocial support. Women Affairs Minister Aisha Jumai Al-Hassan spoke at a recent event in Abuja. She said one of the government's main priorities for the free Chibok girls is to ensure that they return to school, possibly in September.
They are going back to school because they had aspirations. That was why their parents put them in school from where they were abducted. Therefore, when they stabilize and they recover, we'll still put them back in school.
The government said the girls will not return to their former school in Chibok, which has sparked criticism from activists and the girls' families. But the government says it is protecting the girls and monitoring their rehabilitation, which includes recreational activities, weekly religious programs, and classes in biology, math, and English. The rehabilitation is expected to last 9 months. Wherever they are, the fact that they are not with the terrorist is considered okay for them. Bring Back Our Girls group member Alan Manasse spoke to some of the girls at the rehab center, and he told VOA that they said they are doing fine. Two of Manasse's cousins are among the Chibok girls still missing. Foreign governments and aid groups are helping out in the rehab process. The Canadian government recently donated dignity kits containing sanitary items and clothes to the free Chibok girls. They smiled while the kits were handed out, but did not make any statements. Christopher Thornley is the Canadian High Commissioner to Nigeria.
The Chibok girls are symbolic of a vast humanitarian challenge affecting millions of lives. This is why Canada has stepped up this year to provide $27 million to UN agencies and NGO partners for humanitarian assistance in the Northeast. This includes $2 million that we have provided to UNFPA to support the Chibok girls as well as its interventions in the Northeast.
The Chibok girls were Boko Haram's largest and most high-profile kidnapping. The militants abducted 276 girls from their dormitories in Chibok in April 2014. More than 100 of the girls are still missing. The Nigerian government says hostage negotiations with Boko Haram are ongoing. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 13th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. One-third of the world's population is considered overweight or obese, and the country with the highest percentage of obese adults is Egypt. As viewer Jessica Bremer reports, the authors of a new report called the problem a growing and disturbing public health crisis.
2.2 billion children and adults worldwide, or 30% of all people, are affected by diseases connected to excess weight, according to researcher Christopher Murray, director of the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Results of the massive study were presented at the Eat Stockholm Food Forum meeting in Sweden and published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The IHME evaluated health information from 195 countries and territories from 1980 through 2015. The prevalence of obesity, according to Murray, has doubled during the past 25 years in more than 70 countries and increased in most of the others. Murray says excess kilograms are causing more than 4 million deaths each year, 40% in people who are overweight but not technically considered obese.
The main contributors to death in terms of, you know, the causes are a big chunk is heart disease, particularly ischemic heart disease, but others as well. A number of different cancers that have been linked to overweight and obesity, and then diabetes and chronic kidney disease.
The data came from the Global Burden of Disease Study, a systematic scientific investigation to quantify the impact on society of all major diseases, injuries, and risk factors by age, sex, and population. In the United States, 79.4 million adults were considered overweight or obese in 2015. China followed with 57.3 million in sheer numbers of adults above a healthy weight. The country with the highest percentage of obese adults is Egypt, where 35% of the adult population is obese. The highest level of obesity among children and young adults was in the United States at nearly 13% of the population. China has the most obese children, 15.3 million youngsters, and India is next with 14.4 million. Vietnam and Bangladesh had the lowest percentage of overweight and obese individuals overall at just 1% of the population. Murray notes there's no single factor that's contributing to the increasing numbers of people with a weight problem.
The combination of, you know, less physical activity, more calories, you know, more carbohydrates, contributing to this trend that we're seeing that's quite global.
During the next decade, IHME researchers and the UN Food and Agricultural Organization plan on gathering and sharing the best evidence-based strategies to tackle the epidemic of obesity worldwide. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Next month, July 16 to the 18, a group of seven students and one mentor will be representing Zambia at the first global robotics competition in Washington, D.C. The competition is aimed at promoting science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, also known as STEM. Nearly 160 countries, including 40 from Africa, will compete in the 2017 First Global Challenge. The ultimate goal is to provide all nations and their students with an understanding of how STEM careers are a realistic and viable option for the future of young people. Peter Longu is executive director of the Zambia Institute for Sustainable Development. He is also mentor of Team Zambia. He and team leader Mwenge Pekansambo tell me they are looking forward to interacting with other young scientists from around the world.
I take it as a privilege and not a right to represent my country. I think it's once in a lifetime that someone gets to represent their country. So it's really inspiring to be amongst the team that's going to represent Zambia and fly our flag very high but most importantly, to also be the mentor for 7 billion students. So I'm really excited about the opportunity.
This is a robotic kind of a sports, but what is your team bringing to the competition? Did you design a particular robot, or what are you bringing?
We were given a kit by FES Global. It's a standard kit that everyone has, and then we are supposed to design a robot in terms of having a unique design that will do different tasks. The 160 team, each one has to design a robot to face different challenges. So maybe I can give Mwengo to talk about that. That's fine.
Okay, yeah, please go ahead.
So the challenge is based on the theme of aqua and hydro, supplying clean and safe water to everyone. Our bot is supposed to be designed in a way in which you can collect water particles and contaminated particles in a fake river and take contaminated particles to a laboratory. So we need to be able to collect those particles, sort them out. And of course, for extra bonus points at the end of the whole match, we should be able to get ourselves off the ground when the flood comes into the arena.
It's very nice to talk with you. First of all, Madam Team Captain, I attended primary and secondary schools in Africa, back in my home country of Liberia. Back then, it seemed that certain academic subjects were untouchable for girls. What is it like now for girls participating in the science, technology, and engineering and mathematics study in Zambia? What is it like?
It's the best feeling in the world. You know, my mother raised me with the sense that, you know, you're able to accomplish anything. Never take it that certain things are not meant for you and certain things can never be touched by you. So for me, it's something that I love to engross myself in and get involved. And I think it's the best thing possible that could ever happen to the world, actually.
Peter, are you there?
Yes, James, I'm here.
According to the information, 130 countries have committed to attend. Do you have any idea, besides Zambia, how many other countries are coming from Africa?
From Africa, we have Zimbabwe, we have Botswana, we have Cameroon, we have Egypt, we have Togo. So basically, there are a lot of countries from across Africa that are participating. I mean, as I said, it's quite interesting because we have all these kids from across Africa who are obviously going to compete at the world stage with countries like Japan and all those places basically on the same platform.
So, Peter, who is funding your team? The government of Zambia, or are you being funded privately?
Well, we are privileged enough that we managed to have one of our students admitted to Harvard University, Stella Kasepa. So through Stella Kasepa, I've been able to secure funding from Harvard University.
I want to speak to your team captain again. Of course, this competition, like in every sporting competition, is to win. Apart from the goal to win, what lessons do you think your team can learn from?
Teamwork. That's the first thing, cooperating. Because, you know, in each and every situation, even though you wish to win, you can either go the race alone and try by all means to go far, or go with it together, put your ideas together, and get even further than you would alone. Out of everything, I think the one lesson that we have learned is cooperation, because in our team, we have people coming from right across Zambia, from the northernmost part to the southernmost tip of Zambia. That's where we come from. So we don't have the same living environments where we come from. And to come together, put our ideas together, and actually cooperate, even though it may not be the best or what we're used to, I think that's the greatest thing that we've learned out of all this.
Talk to young Zambian or young African women about the importance of getting into the study of science.
The study of science is vast and it's ever-changing. There is no reason for us not to be involved in that change. Think of the doctors who are now women. We have PhDs, like my very own mother who holds a PhD in obstetrics and gynecology. She's taken that step into science. Why can't we also take that step into science? There's so many things that we could do. So don't settle for less when you know you can do so much more.
Are you there, Peter?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Just a final word before we go. What are your expectations coming to Washington, back to Washington? I know you've been here before. Some of the young people you are bringing, have they ever been here before to Washington or to the United States?
I think most of my team, I think apart from myself, it's the first time coming to the U.S. So for me, it's a good step. I think the biggest prize we'll win from all of the experience is networking, because I say that, well, Africa is a global village and the world is. So us getting to meet all these great minds, I mean, I've interacted with people from across Venezuela, and all these kids, once they get there, I think there'll be like a cross-pollination of ideas which is relevant to sort the world's problems. So for me, them saying that they've been here and opening their eyes, they'll come back to Zambia with new perspective on life to say, look, we can do it within there. And hopefully they'll come back and implement the change and not just be spectators and just say, we went to America and to the good place. But what they learn, so the lessons that they'll learn, I think that's very, very critical.
Peter, so nice to talk with you and your team captain. Very inspiring. I look forward to seeing or meeting you and your team when you come to Washington. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, James, and hopefully we'll see you in Washington, D.C.
Peter Longo is the mentor of Zambia's robotic team to the first global robotic competition scheduled for next month in Washington, D.C. He and team leader Mwenge Penkatsambo spoke with me from Lusaka. Norway is hosting a conference of spiritual and indigenous leaders this month to help fight deforestation throughout the world. The conference will focus on rainforests throughout the world, including the Congo Basin. Lars Lavoe is head of Rainforest Foundation Norway. He spoke with Ricky Stryak about why protecting the Congo Basin rainforest is important to the entire world, not just Central Africa.
In rainforest countries, particularly the DRC and elsewhere, church and religious groups are very strong. Actually, the church and religion is in every village, and the religious networks are strong and effective. A little bit in contrast to the government. And the other thing is that church has a moral authority. So if they engage to protect the tropical rainforest, they can make a tremendous difference.
What can indigenous forest communities, specifically ones in DRC, teach that can help change maybe people's mind, people in the world that judge the value of rainforests through the how much can one economically make off of this rainforest?
You know, many indigenous peoples in Congo, particularly the Pygmies, have extremely tight connections. They are tied to the forest. That's their area. The forest is their home, which provides them with everything. So they have a respect for nature and for Mother Earth that is overlooked by many other social groups and actors. On the other hand, we also see that around the world, in the Amazon and elsewhere, where indigenous peoples are granted territorial rights or user rights to their traditional territories, the forest is much better protected than elsewhere. If you talk about price and utility, the forest that we don't value, it gives us rain and distributes rainfall all over the globe. It produces clean water. It protects nutrients. It stores billions of tons of carbon. And it does that in an extremely efficient way. So what many people may think as romantic is also actually efficient.
How important is the rainforest in the Congo Basin and how threatened is it?
The rainforest in the Congo Basin is essential for two things in the region. It contains almost all the living creatures, I mean, the biodiversity of the region, and it regulates the climate in Africa. So a lot of the rainfall that falls in drier areas come from the rainforest. So we need, and Africa needs, to protect its rainforest for its future livelihood. At the same time, illegality, illegal logging, road constructions, mining, corruption, all threatens the rainforest. We need, and Africa needs, to develop plans to protect the forest and actually to reward those groups, those communities or provinces that protect their forest. Because the ambiguity is that the one who destroys the forest actually gets money for it. He can sell timber. So the destructors are rewarded and the protectors are not. And we have to change that logic.
Lars Lavoe is head of Rainforest Foundation Norway. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Oslo. That's it for this Tuesday, June 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the challenges facing women and girls in Africa on their road to empowerment. We'll examine the current situation and look ahead at the way forward. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.